the New Zealand Business Podcast, brought to you by Guerrilla Technology, your strategic and proactive IT partner.
Greetings and welcome along to the New Zealand Business Podcast. Have a bit of a treat for you today. I spent some time with Linda Jenkinson. Now, Linda Jenkinson really has been quite an innovator in the field of entrepreneurship. She's a Kiwi who's really taken on the world, and a lot of time in the US, building business over there. She's also founded a not-for-profit, successfully raised hundreds of millions of dollars of capital, and has quite a story to tell. So I think you're really going to enjoy this one. So without further ado, let's jump straight in.
Well, Linda, it's a real treat to be able to sit down with you. Thank you very much for taking the time. I know your plate's been pretty full with lots of things going on, so thanks very much. Maybe you could start by giving us an intro to your background, where you grew up, and how you ended up finding yourself in this world of business and entrepreneurship.
Well, I grew up in a farm in Hewanui in the Manawatu, and Hewanui means higher ridge, and it's basically the top of the Manawatu plain right below the wind farm. So I always say I grew up in a headwind, which is why I'm such a stroppy Kiwi chick. And my father was a born entrepreneur, and he started about 20 businesses over my life. And I was his right-hand man from the age of 10 years old. So I was really brought up with a passion for creating things. That's just what you did. I never really knew anything different. And I think I decided to launch into business. I wanted to, you know, I think when I was like 21 years old, John Green from Pricewaterhouse, you know, sat me down in my first job, and he said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, you know, I want to make a difference in the world. And that was really always my ethos. And my view was to do it through the medium of business, because that's what my dad, that's what he did. He started things. So yeah, I learned how to start things. But dad could never get them beyond the 2 million. You know, he had 20 small businesses, like, you know, $2 million business. So he was, so I wanted to figure out how to take them, how to scale it, how to take a business from like a $2 million business and turn it into a $200 million business. And so that's when I went out of when I left Palmerston North to first of all move to Wellington and then go global. That was really my quest, was to figure out how to do that.
And so did that influence your studies? What did you study?
Yeah, very much influenced my studies. Well, it's interesting. You know, I studied everything, which is a little bit different. But, you know, back in those days, you know, I did school certificate and I did all of the arts, so music, history, geography, you know, English, science, math. And then in the sixth form, I did all the sciences, physics, chemistry, biology, etc. And then I left school and went to secretarial school and learned how to type and do shorthand. And then I decided to go to university, where I did computer science, accounting, and finance.
Well, that is quite an eclectic mix of things that you studied there.
Yeah, well, I've always really been interested in how everything works, so I'm incredibly curious. So for me, it was how do you make the connections and make the dots and understand it all. And so, and I decided to do business at university because I wanted to understand business. I see business as a process. So, you know, most people, like I saw my father, you know, they do things they're passionate about. So they become something. They become a doctor or they become a panel beater. And then they suddenly get to the point where they start a business. And they think that that's just straightforward, where to me a business person is a skill set and a set of processes just like any of those things are. And I wanted to understand how to make that work. And so even in my first jobs were going and working in banking, restructuring banks, sourcing, where I basically got to work in every industry. I got to analyze every industry and understand it. So I got this very broad general education that really then enables me to it just gives me a huge advantage in building a business because I understand every single element of it in a multi-dimensional way, which is quite unique.
I can see that being very helpful. And as Kiwis, we tend to be a little bit more multi-talented than is common in larger markets, I tend to find.
Oh, completely. In America, you specialise right down to this, where Kiwis are generalists, which is often, it's a positive and a negative. So that's where the negative was, we don't necessarily understand how to build really big things, but we're very good at doing everything. So it's a real strength and weakness of Kiwis, you know.
So you worked out that, you know, you worked out to learn about that variety, and then you obviously added in the key things that you needed to know to be able to grow something much bigger. So what was the work that you did that led into founding your own first business?
I had a few businesses before my quote-unquote, you know, it's sort of like, you know, I think the first business, the first really visible one, and that was a real adventure. I was working in Wellington, New Zealand, and I was working in consulting because I wanted to get exposure to other businesses because I wanted to see what my father wasn't doing to learn how to do that. So I thought consulting would be a great way to do that because I could be in these big companies and understand how big companies work.
Makes sense.
And at the time, New Zealand was in a massive state of privatisation, and they'd bought Booz Allen over to restructure Data Bank, which was a clearing facility for the four banks. And they had all these Americans arrive. And Data Bank, National Bank at the time, anyway, called up Pricewaterhouse and said, look, all these Americans have arrived. We don't know what to do with them. Would you send someone over to sort them out? So I was the one that was sent over, my little 23-year-old was sent over to sort out the Americans. Well, as a good Kiwi, you know, I was working as an associate at Pricewaterhouse. I was, you know, nightlining. I was only of two woman waitresses at Plymouth House, which was then the premier restaurant. You know, that was a big deal in Wellington. Yeah. And I was developing real estate on the side as well. So within 2 weeks, I'd adopted these Americans, and I'd, of course, taken their money and invested them in real estate projects. And the deal was they didn't know anybody, but they had all those houses on the terrace, you know, those corporate apartments.
Yeah.
So the partners couldn't figure out how these guys had been there for 2 weeks, and they supplied the alcohol and the food. How they could have 200 drunk Kiwis because showing up at the house. And I'd taken their money and invested it in different things. So just gave them a real Kiwi journey. And for me, got exposed to, you know, the strategy thinking of strategy consulting, the McKinsey, the Booz. I'd never been exposed to that sort of thinking before.
Fantastic.
So it was an incredible synergy. And so one of the guys, the guy who was project managing the American side, and I was project managing the Kiwi side, this guy Greg Kidd, we were down on Oriental Parade one day, and he says, you know, because, you know, I'm so business, and he came from a very sort of academic corporate family. He goes, you know, why don't we build a $1 billion business and, you know, you run it and I'll be the ideas guy. And so I said, okay, why not? And so that's where DMS started.
Wow.
And so we were restructuring Data Bank, and there were a couple of guys who were programmers there. So they started, as Kiwis do, doing the extra job of working with us. And we tried to figure out what business to buy. And so we looked, being consultants, we looked around the world and identified five opportunities, and we were looking for things where New Zealand was incredibly different to the rest of the world that we could then take to the rest of the world. And it turned out same-day delivery because of Data Bank, because New Zealand had to figure out how to get overnight delivery in quite a remote country that had it for 20 years. So we figured out that New Zealand had the most efficient same-day delivery market in the world, highest service, lowest cost. And so we picked that one. And so then we bought this little company, and so, it was tiny, $50,000 or something. At the time, it seemed like a big deal, right? And we went and analysed. We were trying to figure out why New Zealand was so good at this, and, you know, we figured out a lot of things. And then there was one guy, and this guy was five times more productive than anyone else. right? Wow. So most courier dispatchers dispatch 200 jobs a day.
Yes.
This guy dispatched 1,000 a day. So, you know, went and sat behind him and watched him, and he was basically a lazy bugger. So everybody else, you know, controlled everything, and he just sat down, and he was this cruisy guy, and he basically said he called everything out on the radio, and everyone then everyone decided which ones they wanted. It was very Kiwi democratic.
Yes.
But basically what that meant was, and then what happened is, you know, he said, come on, you got everyone working together. So basically normally what would happen with a courier is either dispatcher would get in my seat. I couldn't leave it for 10 hours because I had to remember where everybody was. And I had to just say, okay, there's a pickup here. Pete, it's your job. Even though it might be that Linda was right next door, then Linda would get angry because she's favouring Pete, but he doesn't know where everyone is,
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah.
So with this system, basically, Linda would say, hey, I'm right here. She would come up the building, and then she would take all the packages, not just the one that was going north.
Yes.
And then she would go down the building on the radio herself, radio the other couriers and saying, I'm going north. Who's going south? And then you'd swap. So in this instance, the couriers were 5 times more productive.
That's incredible.
As well. And so the couriers made a lot more money. So we developed this whole model. And then there were all these, like, issues that, people wouldn't pick up packages when you lived at the top of the hill because it was easy to go just down the road. So we changed the pricing to relate to effort. So we completely mapped the topography. So you were just as incented because you got twice as much money if you went biked up the hill.
Yes.
Than if you went just down the road.
Brilliant.
And then, you know, Uber's done it now, but we did it where, okay, 1 hour delivery is one price, 30 minutes is twice as much, 15 minutes is 4 times as much. And but also with our system, when you're sending a package, the thing that you most care about is somebody going to pick it up quickly. You don't really care if it's there an hour and 5 minutes. And so with our system, it was like in 10 minutes, your packages would be gone. So there were only half as many calls into the service center to say, where's my courier to pick it up? So it was multiple elements. Anyway, so that fundamental model that we got by watching this one guy in Wellington, we then built into 6,500 couriers around the world in 80 cities and listed it on the NASDAQ.
That is a great story.
So Kiwi, you know, And then we built it based on technology, you know, pre-today. It was completely innovative at the time. So
what technology was available to you then?
We used Apple computer. It was all Apple-based. And, you know, we built it all. It was proprietary systems back in those days before, you know, everything we have today. It had to be completely distributed. It had to be real-time, you know, thousands of transactions. You know, we owned... we owned like the biggest courier system in London and New York and multiple cities, so San Francisco.
So how did you grow from that base in Wellington out to the rest of the world? How did you make that transition? Obviously, you started with that strategy and that you mentioned about the idea at the beginning, that seed to build the billion-dollar business. But there's quite a few steps in between. It can't have been an easy process to get to that point. These things take a lot of hard work and time, right?
Do you watch Star Trek?
I do from time to time.
Right, okay. So you heard of the Borg?
Yes.
Right, so we had a very much that sort of view. Mm. We will assimilate.
Mm.
So we didn't really think – we basically made this decision that we were going to build this thing. And so I think this is one of the, you know, I'm writing a book right now called The Formula Girl. And this is one of the formulas, right? Because mostly you see people think, well, I'm gonna make a water bottle or I'm going to make this, right? We decided that we wanted to make a $1 billion thing. So when you have that view, it's then a matter of working backwards to say, how do I do it? So that was always our view. We never had a view that we couldn't do it. It was just a matter of how. And so so that was the decision. It's interesting, isn't it? It's like a decision to work out. It's the same type of intention.
Yes.
So everything you build with a view of how can I scale it and what does that look like and how can I build something that's going to grow at a pace that works. You know, we acquired 67 countries around the world and we had a very Borg-like approach in that we would go into a market and we would say, okay, we're going to be number one in this market, and we're going to acquire a number of companies, and look at our track record, our track board record is we can take a market and with 3 years we can own 60 to 70% of the market with our model. Half the people would laugh at us and think we're crazy. Everyone thought we could never implement that model in that city because it couldn't be done here. And if we had to start with this, in the first city we went to, which was San Francisco out of New Zealand, the only company that would allow us to try it was a two-courier company. Everyone else thought we were ridiculous. Within 18 months, we were the dominant provider. We ended up putting five small companies together that then became the dominant player in the market. So the next market we went into, we got number two player. And the next market we went to, we got into number one player. When we went to London, we went to number one. They said no. We went to one, two, three. You know, and so what happened is the ones who didn't come on board, then their management team would leave and come and join us because they could see what was going to happen.
They could see how it worked.
Yeah.
So what sort of offer did you put to these companies? What
we did the first 3-4 years was we built in America. So we went into 30 cities with San Fran as the base. And we we basically took percentage of revenue in exchange for putting our technology and our operational model in place. So we implemented in 39 companies. And then what we did was we then listed it and we bought 20 of those companies outright and put them into our company.
Right. So you didn't have to have a massive amount of funding to get rolling.
Basically, we were able to take these companies that traditionally made 2 to 5% margin and didn't typically maxed out at about $2.5 million in revenue.
Yes.
There were 4,000 messenger courier companies in America, and we could take them to 20 to 25% margin, and we could build these lovely little $25, $30, $50 million companies in each of these markets that then connected together. So for the owners, we basically said we didn't need to, because we said, okay, if we can't do that, then we won't take any ownership, and we were able to deliver that.
That's very slick.
Yeah.
And
it was a lot of work. We had what's called the refrigerator strategy. So, you know, there's all these new words now for agile and all stuff. We did all of that. It's funny, yeah. So our refrigerator strategy was we had all these Kiwis who want to do OE, right? So we'd have them as our implementers when we went into a city.
Yes.
And so they would live in people's floors and couches, as Kiwis do,
yes,
and eat out of their refrigerator.
Yeah.
And then we would build these markets up, right? So it was basically bootstrapping it. We didn't raise any money till within 6 months of the IPO, and we raised $2 million. The rest of it we funded ourselves through operating and other things.
Wow. And then what was the trigger for you to do that stock exchange listing, to list on the NASDAQ?
So at the time you know, we were comfortably building the company. The roll-up, you know, different phases come through. And so the roll-up phase came. And so a couple of players came into the market and started to look to buy companies. So we felt that we were a pure value play. So we had a better story than they did. So why shouldn't we do it? So we decided to. And because you had some comparatives in the market, and there was a lot of – it's so funny because you've got – like Uber, like we were doing, you know, we had the same model for black cars. So my investment banker called me up and he just says, every time I say Uber, all I can think of is DMS, you know, it's that type of thing, the wave. So you take opportunities when you see them.
Mm-hmm. And what happened after the IPO? Where to from there?
Well, I 6 weeks before the IPO, I had a serious accident and I broke my back in three places and just about killed myself. So I, about a year after, decided that I needed to take some time out. So I took a year off, a sabbatical, and got my health, fixed my back up.
Very wise.
And I sort of didn't want to miss out on having kids and family. Mm. So I and then I really had an epiphany at the time because I'd worked really hard for 10 years because when I left New Zealand, I went off to Wharton and did my master's. We wrote a book on restructuring the commercial banking industry in the US that went very well, restructured banks. At the same time, we were building this company. And I ended up, you know, making partner in 6 years and then left the day I made partner, and 9 months later listed DMS on the NASDAQ, and we bought another like 30 companies in the next year, you know, broke my back. It's just a very intense 10 years. And so I'd really hadn't spent time, you know, I worked 6 days a week and did my laundry and slept on the seventh, you know. And so when I listed the company, I sort of realized, you know, I thought that then I would be happy. But I realized that was just such a myth, you know. I've got lots of fun stories, but one story was we just about didn't make it, right? So I'd walked away from, you know, I'd just made partner, you know, seven figures, expense account. My husband is still scarred from me walking away from it to do this, to take the cut. So we got, the same day I made partner, we got offers from 8 investment banks to take us public. So I quit the partnership and we were on the path, and we were about 6 months in, and we just filed what's called, so we had Smith Barney and Prudential Securities as our underwriters. We just filed our S1, and
what's the S1?
So S1 is so the Securities Exchange. You have to file all the documents for them to approve it, and that's the document that then gets filed with them, which then you can market. So you can't. So when you do an IPO, you package that information together.
Yes.
You get your S1, and then you, with the investment bank, go and find the investors who's going to invest in the company. And then when you have enough interest, then you list it. So it's a three-step process. So we just filed our S1, and we were just about to file our S1, and Smith Barney called us up and said, we don't think we can do it. We think you should do a private debt offering. And the problem was, the timing was, it is, we'd stacked all these owners up to do it. And I wish I knew better now. I know better now. But they were completely in love with the idea of going IPO.
Yes.
Even though they could have made more money going private first and then listing. So we were too far down the track, right? So I said, okay, then. So restructured everything, called up Prudential and said, would you step up and be number one? And bought another bank in, you know. And so a pile of our investors got very jittery. And so one of the guys, so I turned around to this guy, and he's, you know, like a billionaire, right? This is chump change for him. I go, all right, then. I said, I bet you I can do this. He says, all right, then, what do you want? And I says, I'll have a new Porsche Carrera, grey with tan seats. And he says, all right. So we shook hands. And, you know, when I listed it, I got my new Carrera with a red bow around it, you know. And so it's like, so then effectively he just thought I was so gutsy for saying that, you know, he really helped me a huge amount in terms of doing it. And he's a mentor and a dear friend today. But that was sort of like Kiwi gutsiness and ingenuity in terms of, you know, how that came out.
That's fabulous.
But, you know, like then, you know, the day that the investment bank pulled out, we'd been funding it all on my American Express card, and I'd got it up to $125,000, and Amex called and cut my card off. And so at that point, you got no choice, right? You got to like double down and go for it. Otherwise, you're, you know.
Wow.
So anyway, voila.
Well, that all ended out well. So.
And I got the Porsche.
And you got the Porsche. That's, yeah. I mean, that's great. What do you drive these days?
I still have the Porsche, but actually that's in San Francisco. But I'm going to – my first car, my dad – when I wanted to get my license, my dad said, okay, you go and work and you can pay 50% of it. And so I bought a Mini Miner for $1,500, and it had a big hole in the middle of the – my mother wouldn't drive in it because it made her get seasick. And so my son is about to start driving in 6 months, so I'm going to buy a Mini Miner manual to run around in, and so he can learn to drive in it.
Oh, that is
so
fantastic.
My New Zealand car is a Mini Miner, and my US car is a Porsche Carrera S.
slight difference there.
I love contrast in
that's
life.
That's great. So, and where are you based now? Because I, you know, saw on your email signature there's a US phone number, an Australian phone number. You're obviously spending a chunk of time in New Zealand as well. Where do you call home?
Well, I'm a global citizen, but a Kiwi at heart. And so I've just relocated. So I'm basically Wellington, San Francisco for the next few years.
Okay.
With a bit good in Sydney.
It seems to Melbourne. Be quite a popular sort of combination at the moment. A lot of people sort of like to split their time between New Zealand and New Zealand and California, especially the San Francisco and Bay Area.
Yeah, well, I've lived in San Francisco for 16 years, so I love it there.
Now, your most recent business that has that you've built up, how did that come about? What was it that triggered that?
So after I took my year off and I really thought about what I wanted to do next, I really wanted to. I really believe in businesses where it's not the win lose model where shareholders make a lot of money and the employees and the environment and don't do well. I really believe in the holistic model. It's very important to me, and so I really wanted to and to have some fun.
Especially after
the intensity of DMS, I think I sort of lost the plot before because I'd broken my back, supposedly made lots of money, but it didn't really seem to matter. So I decided after I took a year off and wandered the world that I wanted to start something new, but to do it with a completely different set of principles. So I took on the Buddhist thing. I don't know if you've heard, if you have a glass of water and you put an egg in, it overflows. But if you put an egg in and fill it with water, it doesn't. So I made this decision that I was not going to work 6 days of work, 1 day of sleep, that I was going to work 9 to 5, that I was going to do 3 businesses and a social venture, and I was going to have my kids. And I was never going to miss another family event or major sporting event because I'm sports crazy ever again. And I haven't since.
Fantastic.
So I've had, since then, I've had 2 kids, you know, cat, dogs. I've started, you know, I've built the volunteer fundraising organization for the Red Cross in the Bay Area, started Well for Africa. We started Porthos, which is a wine concierge company. We started I Say So, which became Le Concierge, which became John Paul, which became $100 million global concierge company, which we sold to the Accor Hotel Group last year. We built a few other things too. Porthos, Wow, and Le Concierge were the 3 big ones. But then also, you know, I'm on multiple boards. I'm on the board of the Massey Foundation. I've done, you know, on Air New Zealand. I haven't missed one function since. You know, I was in Rio, I was in Glasgow for the Commonwealth Games, America's Cup, you know.
So you're squeezing a lot in, but you're doing obviously the things that are important to you. Now, tell me about going to Africa and about Wow.
So I started this global women's group and we used to have this – we used to come together in France at this lovely chateau. And I used, with the concierge company, you could run Paris Runway, and we used to do all this supporting each other globally in terms of, it was really before the, you know, Women on Boards movement now. So we sort of started this like 18 years ago with incredible women from all around the world. And so we facilitated, one of my ex-colleagues from Wharton, she was running Nike Women's France, and she got an opportunity. Oxfam was looking for someone from the business world to come in and help revolutionize Oxfam West Africa.
Yes.
And so literally we were in Paris and she got the call for the job. So we were with a woman who was the first manager at McKinsey, and she had these huge insights to Oxfam. So she got the job. So we, 14 of us, went to Dakar to support her, and we ended up, you know, meeting the president, meeting these entrepreneurs, touring the whole – we thought we were going on a beach holiday, you know, and we ended up in the back of nowhere in this place called Chess with 50 Senegalese women, and they had these – all these business plans, you know, beautifully attired in their African regalia. We felt very mousy. And they took us to the sea, and they said, there's the Chinese factory, there's the Lebanese factory. Look at us. All we have is the tables. We want a factory, and we want to run it. We want it to be ours. So at that time, you know, the president called and wanted to meet us. So we raised like $250,000 US in the back of the car on the way back to help these women. And so then when I got back to San Francisco, it was like, well, who's going to go and do it? And I'm like, all right, well, I will. So off I went, and I ended up spending like 23 weeks on the ground in Senegal. And we figured out at the time that what you needed was a low cost, like a 2%, a low interest fund.
Yes.
Because you needed to train them how to get to the point where they can get their own financing. And then a business incubator, which provided all the support. So the business incubator was the nonprofit, and the low interest fund was the for profit. So we put the nonprofit in the US and the fund in the Cayman Islands, and we put it together. So we created a synthetic sustainable, which is now like a B Corp. You know, there's all these new types of companies, and partnered with the government, with Oxfam, and we built that. So we did fund one with that. So it was very innovative at its time. So I ended up just did a lot of great things from there.
That's fantastic. So can you share one or two of the outcomes that came from that in terms of things that people were able to start?
Yeah, it was interesting. I think I'll sort of do a macro and a micro. I think one of the things I really felt strongly about was, you know, I've got, well, it used to be bright hair, red hair and freckles and clearly of European descent. And I thought, yeah, I don't want to go into Africa and, you know, do another save the world because, you know, $56 billion have gone to Africa and it's actually helped make it poorer, right? So my view is, you know, the world of for-profit where you make lots of money but you take it out of the environment and da-da-da, and then non-profit where you go in and try and save people but you're not really there to empower them. It's great for short term, but it's not really a skill set for long term. So I really learned that in that experience. And so we did everything 50-50. So we were all about how could we be very lightly treading. So we're really more facilitators.
Yes.
So we built student programs and anything we brought Stanford and Berkeley students in, but then we brought all the students from Dakar University and we put the graduate programs together. And so just like I did when I was in Wellington, New Zealand, and I got exposed to that American thinking and it was like blew my mind.
Yes.
Doing that for these kids in Dakar and then built their network. So at every level we did that, right? So it wasn't we took, you know, really great African entrepreneurs and they were the ones that ran it and facilitated it with the woman. You know, we bought, as opposed to a lot of the NGOs' view of African government, they're corrupt, they're XYZ. You know, the question, if you meet a lot of Africans, they say, well, if you've got the choice of your child dying or taking, what would you choose? You don't, you know, your view of this is completely warped, right? So really saying, okay, if you look at great collaborations, it's government, business, and education. So we built those alliances and brought that together as part of it. So that was a great learning, but then giving that as an example. So when New Zealand launched Knowledge Wave, they looked at Silicon Valley and saw that triangle. Well, it's the same triangle. So we took that to sort of Senegal. And then I was able to take that and really start talking in America about the responsibility of giving money. Because to me, it's not about saving a child. It's about empowering a mother. So if you empower the mother, she'll educate, she'll give health, she'll clothe her child. She doesn't want somebody else to do it. But no, that's not sexy. It's much easier to, you know, with the Red Cross, they get all this money when it's an emergency. But if the money went to actually preventing it or being prepared for it, there wouldn't be so many emergencies. So how do you facilitate that? That's not easy because people love drama, reality TV. Oh, my God, that's terrible. The reality is, you know, it's actually the fundamentals that are key. You know?
Yeah, it's much easier to get the attention for the crisis than for just the things that will make a deeper change maybe over a longer period.
And the good news is, you know, this movement in the States anyway started a good, you know, 17, 18 years ago. So it's starting to become mainstream now, which is fabulous. Because when I first started speaking, when I came out of Africa, people thought I was just the devil. You know, what? It's no good that I give money. It's such accountability when you give someone money because you can take away their power, you know, and then they get used to it. And, you know, so the whole So we changed that whole dynamic, and they were so proud of themselves, and that, and they got confidence from that, and then you supported them in that, and then they launched, you know, and then you've left a structure there that supports it, you know.
That's fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah, so I, you know, so I'm, it's very much what I'm up to anyway.
I can understand how satisfying you know that must be with you know, helping and empowering in that way, rather than the traditional sort of, you know, dumping funds for particular things that,
yeah. And it's one reason why I'm really excited to be back in New Zealand, because one of the things I often questioned myself was, why am I in Africa doing this, and aren't I being a bit hypocritical, and I really should do this at home? Because people now think, oh, I'm gonna need to go and help the third world. Well, the reality is there is no third world. In every country, there's wealthy, middle class, and the poor. And actually, you should look to your own community first, right? So I'm really looking forward to be part of the New Zealand community.
That's great. That's great. So where to from here? What's next on your agenda?
Well, I'm having a rest and reconnecting to my New Zealand roots. I'm writing a book this year called The Formula Girl, because if you looked at my quest when I left, was to figure out how to scale things. So I don't really see myself as a startup person. I don't really care what it is, as long as it aligns with my principles, circular, sustainable, win-win-win, the market, business model. Because to me, profit is all about sustainability. About, you know, fair, great, you know, wage, to treating people with respect, the environment with respect, and building things that make a difference, you know, that have impact on people. That's, as long as it fits with those principles, it doesn't, you know, I don't care what it is. I've learned that skill set of how to take something from 2 million and turn it into something that's 200 million US. So, you know, so The Formula Girl is about showing how to, the formulas, the way of thinking that I've learnt and how to do that.
Mm. And when you look at New Zealand and the New Zealand businesses that you see now that you're, you know, spending a lot of time back here, what do you think are the things that we most need to learn and we most need to, you know, take hold of, so that as a country we're succeeding more on the global market? Obviously, we've had some great successes, you know, some of which you've made those happen. But I guess there are a lot of smaller businesses in New Zealand that have dreams of being global, of growing into billion-dollar businesses, and only a very small percentage of them achieve those goals.
It's interesting. I've been, since 2000, I joined the NZTE Beachhead in Silicon Valley, been very involved in Kia and many organizations in San Francisco supporting Kiwis. So I've seen so many Kiwi companies coming into the US market. And I think this is partly where my book ultimately came for, because it's like 17 years of trying to help Kiwi companies. And I think I see a few things, which, like, when I remember the day that Greg Kidd asked me that question. And it was such a unique question. And I think that's a question that I ask whenever I speak a lot. And when I ask that question, most people are like, oh my God, I've never thought like that. And it was, we were with some of my Air New Zealand colleagues and in San Francisco, and we had this fabulous group of young New Zealand CEOs who are based there, and it was a woman who's been very successful. And she turned around to the New Zealand board, you know, which I'm on and was with, and she said, you know, it's not really worth doing unless it's going to be a $1 billion company. And I'm like, wow, isn't that fabulous?
Yeah.
So to me, asking that question in New Zealand, which is, okay, how about thinking about that from the beginning? Because so many people think, I've got to come up with, and when you see them landing on the shores of New Zealand, of the US, they don't arrive with a concept of a company. They arrive with a concept of a product, a thing. And so how do you, it's like changing that state of thinking to what could this be, you know? And I think, you know, New Zealand's come such a long way in the past 16 years. The venture capital's here, you know, the you know, the incubators, the all of this is here. But I still think that those who, like, you know, look what Rob Drury did with Xero. You know, he was in my office when he sold his last company to Microsoft. We were just doing a beta for him. We were just about to do it, and you know, then he took that and he's done it, right? So, but that way of thinking, that question is very important, and changing your sights around that, you know. So I think that's what. So I think there's a whole series of questions and challenges, and getting clear who wants to and who doesn't. Because there's a lot of people that it's quite okay to do a product. Just know that it's a product, and there's a lot of people in Silicon Valley do that. They build it, they sell it, voila, you know. So
yeah, I guess for the future of New Zealand, you know, we need to keep. Leveraging those unique talents that you talked about earlier, we've got to keep building and doing new things, right?
It's just building skill set, right? So it's first of all having the aspiration that you actually want to build something that is a company and not a product. And then secondly, with that in mind, what are all the different things I need to build to get there? And the great news is it's all there, but it's really having – it's being prepared to understand what you don't know, you don't know. And that's the opportunity.
And sometimes that's a lot easier said than done to figure that out.
It is. And so that's why, and because us Kiwis, we're incredibly stubborn, which is great, but it's very challenging in that way. So I've like crafted these experiences. So my book's like Mini Survivor. So I don't actually give you the answer. I give you an experience to create for yourself, to actually learn it yourself. Because that's the only way I was able to learn. So I'm thinking. So that's what I'm. That's my gift to Kiwis.
That's great. Well, we're very much looking forward to the launch of your book. Will that be this year?
I've been promising it for 4 or 5 years. So if I don't deliver it this year, I'm going to be in deep. But that's my plan. Yeah.
Good. Good. Well, thank you very much for your time, Linda Jenkinson. It's been a real privilege, and we really enjoyed hearing from you.
Thank you so much.
Well, that's it. I hope you really enjoyed hearing from Linda Jenkinson. Quite a fascinating story, and boy, hasn't she done well, and has some great expertise that that she's brought back down under. So it will be it'll be interesting to see what businesses that she influences going forward. Now, just a little heads up, we've just recently launched worldpodcasts.com, and on that network we're taking some of the best of New Zealand podcasts to share with the world. In fact, in this month we are launching 3 new podcasts via worldpodcast.com. Stupid Questions for Scientists, which is hosted by Dr. Michelle Dickinson from Nanogirl Labs. We also have the Social Media Strategy podcast launching with Pauline Stockhausen. That's going to be launching at Social Media Marketing World in San Diego this week. And we also have the Pro Video podcast, which is launching. So there's a whole lot coming up. More on those on future episodes, and we hope we'll be able to bring some of those podcasters on and interview them on the New Zealand Business Podcast as well in the future, because each of them in their own right has done very well. So that's us for this episode. Now, if you want to track me down, you can contact me at my website, paulspain.com, and you can also sign up there for my email updates at paulspain.com. All right, that's us. Have a great week. We'll be back again next week with a new episode. See you then.
The New Zealand Business Podcast, brought to you by Guerrilla Technology, your strategic and proactive IT partner.